I hereby introduce to you Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, hey, hey. Welcome back to Amazing FBA, the place to be if you're a UK-based Amazon seller selling in the US or the UK. Welcome back to the podcast. If you've been here before, if you haven't been here before, you're very, very welcome, but you probably will want to go and find some of the other episodes to guide you through more of the basics as well. If you want to check out any of the show notes, they're at the blog www.amazingfba.com. If you want to join our Facebook group, go to www.amazingfba.com/FBF, as in face, B as in book. And the reason you might want to join there is because we have a thriving community of people, and it's also not a huge giant group where you just get lost in millions of daily updates. So about 235 members now, last time I checked, is growing every day. So it's at that perfect sweet spot between too big and too small. It's big enough to have plenty of people there who know what they're doing, quite a lot of experience now, and also quite small so that everyone gets a chance to ask questions and have them answered, doesn't get buried. Also, you don't gonna have to spend hours of your life trawling through updates. So it's a great time to join us. Another resource we offer now is that you can join the membership area that is on the website, which is only for members of the Amazon Insiders Club. So you just, all we need for that is your email address. And we have 6 how-to videos, and I am currently cooking up an email series on how to do some more advanced strategies and some bigger picture thinking, which I think for anyone who's serious about this business, you need to be taking care of that as well. So if you want to join that, it's www.amazingfba.com/welcome. Just a quick update about mentoring, folks. Quite a few of you, when I mentioned it, sounded like you were very interested in mentoring and coaching from me on your Amazon business. So I created a little sign-up page which told you all about what would be involved, including the costs. So it's all up front and transparent. And I'm glad to say that about 9 of you have applied. So thank you very much if you've applied. I'll be waiting to the end of March, so it's only a day after this podcast is created. So if you applied this time and were disappointed, I'm sorry about that, that I have to have a strict limit of 4 people, maximum 5, that I work with at any one time so that I get to know them and their businesses properly, that I can help them with the level of intensity that they need without distracting from my own Amazon business as well. So if you're already on that list, then I will get in touch with you if a suitable vacancy comes up. But if in the meantime you are interested in that, but you're not on the list, do by all means apply. Just go to www.amazingfba.com/mentoring and click on apply here. And you can go on the waiting list, and I'll let you know next time a space becomes available on that program. So folks, now the moment you've been waiting for, sorry for all the commercial breaks, but I'm simply letting you know of ways that I can help you further apart from the podcast. If you want it, if you don't worry, I'm never going to be selling you anything on this podcast. That's not what it's about. It's free. It always will be free. And if anything, I'm going to increase the quality of the free training you get here and the number of podcast episodes that are going to be produced with interviews as well. Now, this is one of a series of interviews that we're hoping to get off the ground, but certainly we've got several people lined up, and this is another humdinger. I think that we had Danny McMillan on last time talking about Amazon ads, which is a huge pain point. We've had fantastic feedback from the Facebook group members about that. And if you want to go back and put in some questions for Danny, don't forget to go to the blog and fill in the poll that we created for that as well, because he's going to come back and do a question and answer session. Now, this one is all about sourcing and suppliers and the whole supply chain. And we've got a fantastic guy, so helpful, so clear thinking, guy with about 15 years experience, I believe, something like that, in the industry. And that man is Peter Zapf of Global Sources. So without further ado, I'm going to pass over to the interview. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Amazing FBA. Really, really delighted today to have an interview with a man who knows so much about this business, massive background in the business of sourcing and suppliers and that whole area that is just such a big head scratch for the new entrepreneur. And I'm still figuring it out myself. So I'm really delighted to welcome to the podcast Mr. Peter Zapf of Global Sources.
Michael, thanks for the introduction. I don't know if I'm that big an expert, but I have some experience. I'll be happy to share what I've learned and what I've seen.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So, Peter, could you tell us a little bit, just start off, give us a sort of 2-minute intro to yourself and how you got into working for Global Sources?
I've been with Global Sources for almost 15 years now, quite a bit of time. I went to grad school, studied international business, and got recruited from there. into global sources. I'm based here in Hong Kong. I've been out in Hong Kong and Singapore for the past 15 years. Wow. So that's kind of how I got here, international business, and then came out here.
Wow. So 15 years in Hong Kong, you certainly got a very deep background in the whole culture there, I guess. What is Global Sources and what does it do?
So Global Sources, we started business about 40 years ago, and we help, you can look at it two ways. We help manufacturers market themselves to global importers, wholesalers, and retailers, or we help overseas buyers find manufacturers and suppliers they want to work with. When we started business, we did that with trade magazines. So you can imagine, you know, a thick magazine with lots of pictures of products from suppliers. That's evolved quite a bit. In 1996, we launched our website, globalsources.com. So that's a sourcing site to find manufacturers, primarily now China manufacturers. Right. And then in the early 2000s, we launched our trade shows. We run our trade shows twice a year, April and October. And three phases aligned with the HKTDC shows and the Canton shows. And we'll be running our electronics show, mobile electronics, gifts and home and fashion accessories this coming April. And then the third thing that we're just starting, we also have a site called Smart China Sourcing. That's really more information about sourcing. And we're also going to be doing a Smart China Sourcing Summit targeted at Amazon FBA sellers here in Hong Kong, co-located with one of our shows in April. So that's a lot about what we do.
Wow. So you're like a one-stop shop. And also it's very interesting to note that in an industry that's sort of come out of nowhere in the last 2 years in terms of being really, you know, well-known, the Amazon selling thing, that you've got a really deep background yourself and the company has as well. And you've moved through the different phases from magazines through trade shows, through the, you know, the web era. And now you're recognizing the needs of FBA sellers.
No, I just need to do a quick comment because, I mean, you're absolutely
Please.
Right. We've seen a lot of changes. You know, 10, 15 years ago, you'd primarily see the buyers that were either using our website or coming to our trade shows. They'd be retailers, right? People that had that worked for companies that had distribution channels. Then in the maybe 2007 and 2008, we started seeing eBay power sellers. And then with eBay FBA, where FBA also takes care of warehousing and customer service, we're really starting to see a lot more Amazon sellers. So, but as you point out, there's been quite a migration in, or a shift in the mix of buyers. I mean, still Amazon buyers will be a minority, but it's definitely a new and growing segment that we're seeing.
Okay, that's interesting. So they're still in a minority, and would that be more eBay sellers or is it big retailers?
No, it would still be traditional sellers. Like at our electronics show, we'll have maybe 30,000 global buyers coming in. And the majority of them will still be trading companies or importers, you know, the traditional distribution channels. I mean, even in the U.S., I think it's still less than 10% of sales are online. So that other 90% is being sourced, you know, traditionally from folks representing traditional channels.
Interesting. Of course, the thing is, if you're wrapped up in the online world, you forget that most of the world still isn't doing most of its business online. It's a very good point. So, Peter, we've got a list of questions here, quite a long list compared to what I was expecting from Facebook members. So I feel that I owe it to them to get into those tactical questions. And then feel free to sort of go off on a little tangent here and there if you feel that, you know, there's something important that is implied by the question, but that, you know, isn't actually asked. What are the pros and cons of using a sourcing agent?
So that's an interesting one. And I think, you know, that's a good way to phrase it, pros and cons. Some people like using sourcing agents, some people don't. I think certainly one of the advantages of having a sourcing agent is you kind of have your guy on the ground that can handle communication directly with the factory in the same time zone. Mm-hmm. Some of the sourcing agents that I talk to, they say that they're able to get, I'll say, local pricing. So they almost pay for themselves through the better pricing they get than you can get from a factory being from overseas.
Right.
There's probably some truth to that. I haven't. It's difficult to test. That being said, on the other hand, with an agent, sometimes it can go the other way. You may not get the best pricing. Agents have a reputation. We're basically getting paid from both sides. So they'll take a percentage from the buyer, but then also tell the factory that the factory has to pay them a percentage. So that becomes an extra cost layer. And then depending on the complexity of your product, if you're working through an agent, you may or you may not have direct communication with a factory. And if you have a more complicated product or you have complicated packaging requirements, you know, it just becomes an extra layer of communication that in some cases may help you, but in some cases may be a hindrance. So, you know, some people use agents, some people don't. It can work both ways.
Well, thank you. That's a very detailed response. It's very interesting what you're saying about the fact that they may save you money or they may cost you money, but you never quite know. And I have to say that does chime in with my experience of China as a whole, is that getting to the facts of the matter is not always that straightforward in my experience. I mean, this is a big area to ask about, but have you got any tips about how to sort of manage that relationship such that you get closer to some facts?
You know, to be honest, a lot of the folks that I talk to, because the folks that come to the shows, they come to the shows themselves, so they don't work through a sourcing agent. Typically what they'll do is it's just a lot of communication. So you might start by finding a supplier online, communicating with them via email, then maybe via Skype. I've even seen people ask the supplier to take the video camera on the supplier's computer and kind of give them a virtual tour of parts of the factory, for instance.
I like that idea.
Yeah, so there are a lot of ways to kind of get to know the supplier better and get to know their business better. Then the next step, obviously, would be to meet them face-to-face at one of the trade shows they attend, or if they don't attend shows, even at their factory. But that's a different investment and a bigger commitment.
Well, that's a very good... that leads me very neatly into the next question, which is from one of our Facebook members, is travel to China to source products necessary to grow your business?
Since I'm an engineer, I'll say, no, it's not necessary.
Right, okay, yeah.
So, you know, I've talked to plenty of folks that source online. They get the samples. They request the samples. They'll pay for the samples via PayPal. They'll receive the samples. They'll send the comments and the request to the supplier. They'll work on packaging requirements with the supplier. And they'll do that all over email, maybe also Skype. And that, you know, that works fine. On the other hand, I've also talked to folks that, you know, tell me they camp out at the factories periodically.
Right.
So, you know, you have both extremes. I think when you're getting started, you don't have to travel to China. If you start making this a full-time business, you can certainly consider traveling to China. And the light travel to China would be just go to the trade shows and meet your suppliers at the trade shows. More heavy might be visit the factories. And again, that's in part going to depend on the complexity of your products and whether you need more face-to-face communication to explain kind of the details of what you want done.
Right. So it's something to certainly look into seriously down the line, or if you're going full-time with it.
Yes, yes.
So another question is, how do you work out what a good price is for a product? Which is a how long is a piece of string question, I realize.
So a good price for a product, what I've seen a lot of buyers do is they get multiple quotes. And this is what we've said the large retailers also do. They'll go out, they'll get multiple quotes. Then they might say to one of the suppliers, hey, we're really excited about working with you, but we have a good price from another supplier. So even though we really like working with you, we're not in a position where we can choose you. Are you able to give us better pricing? So that's one piece. The other piece I would say is price isn't the only factor you really want. I was at the Prosper show in February, and I was talking to some buyers, and they said, hey, we got a really good price, but we can't get the quality that we want. We're getting 5% defect rates on each production run. So, you know, a lot of the sourcing guys here will say you get what you pay for. And if you beat the supplier down on price, they're going to find some way to... you know, be able to produce at that price, but you may no longer be getting the quality that you're looking for. So that's a second point. I think a third point, sorry that there's so many, a third point is, you know, for your selling price on Amazon, your buying price from the supplier is going to be, I mean, let's just say it's 25% or 33% of the selling price. So, you know, if you get a 10% change in the price, that's really only a 2% difference in your selling price. So I'd really focus as much on things like quality that's going to affect your product reviews and product ratings that will have a bigger impact on sales volume than maybe that 1 or 2% difference in price.
Okay, that's so chimes in with my experience, I have to say, because I had a product that was electronic, which is possibly something that was foolish to start with anyway. But yeah, the defect rate was something like, so I read just before I got my shipment in, oh, the defect rates are quite often 10% on electronic things from China. And sure enough, it was about 11%. So I learned quickly that if you're going to go into electronics, that quality control is so much of a bigger problem than price. I mean, really, I could have cared less about the odd cent, you know, on the cost of the price, I have to say, compared to the hassle.
Exactly. And but let me make another comment on price also. And that is that it's not just the price of the product. I've seen people say, wow, I'm not getting a price from the supplier that I can compete with. But then I'm thinking, well, what quantity are you ordering? Are you going direct to factory, or do you have an intermediary there? Are you planning to ocean ship or air ship? Are you shipping direct to FBA, or are you having the product stop somewhere in between? You know, all of these other factors also add costs and impact your potential selling price and your margins. So it's not just product price, it's also how you manage your whole supply chain that affects profitability and selling price.
Yeah, that makes huge sense to me, particularly as UK-based sellers. If we're selling in the USA, which most of us are, and I have done myself and am doing, then yeah, the issue of the supply chain being shorter becomes a bit tricky if you want to go direct to FBA, because sending it to your own house isn't an option. Direct to factory versus an intermediary question is very interesting. How do you work out, or how do you find ways to connect directly to factory owners rather than intermediaries?
You know, that's an interesting question. Even experienced buyers have difficulty with this. One of the things, this one's a little bit more complicated. One of the things that you can do, and we have this on the globalsources.com site, is you can look at the supplier's business license. And if they have a word like manufacturer within their scope of business, then they're much more likely to be a factory than if they don't have a word like that in their scope of business.
Great. That's a very simple way of doing it. I like it.
Yeah, we think that's pretty good. But there are some things you need to be aware of. They may make some things and trade others. So they may have factory within their scope of business for the products that they actually manufacture, but what you may be ordering from them may be something that they don't manufacture.
Okay, interesting. And that sort of feels like China real, because somehow there's no straight answer so far that I've ever encountered in China. So how can you tell which ones they would manufacture, if there is a way?
Well, I think what I've seen by, I mean, this is where you start getting to visiting the factory or hiring somebody to visit the factory and comparing the name on the registration at the entryway with the name of the company you're dealing with and the name on the business card that you're dealing with, and seeing if it's all consistent.
Right. That makes sense. So basically at that point, if you want to check any further, you probably need a person involved, either yourself or an agent of some kind.
Or one of the inspection companies. Plenty of them will also do they tend to do slightly heavier factory audits or factory checks.
Okay.
Many of them will do that.
So that isn't a question that people have asked for some reason, but that would be my first question after my lovely experience of my 11% defect rate. Tell me about inspection and quality control. What are your sort of basic recommendations?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. And this really does depend on the product, but I would even recommend this for a simple product. And this is a process that I think works well, even if people find it heavy. And I'll go through a few steps. First thing is, get several samples. For every sample that you get, write down everything that you don't like about it, right? Everything and that becomes your quality control criteria. So you don't just write, I don't like it, but when an inspector is checking it, I want them to check for this. I want them to check for scratches. I want them to check for dents. I want them to turn this on and off and make sure it works. I want them to put the batteries in and make sure the batteries go in easily. And you want to make those QC steps as objective as possible. So now you have a list of QC criteria that you can include with your purchase order when you select one of the factories. So you send in your purchase order, you also send in your QC criteria, and then the factory either accepts or doesn't accept. But then everybody has a common understanding of what your quality requirements are.
That's really very good. I really wish I'd spoken to you before I started in this whole business, because that's so clear-minded. That's so simple. Like, why didn't I think of that? That's really very good.
Yeah, but there's a few more steps. The next step is most factories You'll then want to make your initial payment, often 30%, because they need working capital to buy raw materials. Mm-hmm. Don't pay 100% at this point, right? You have to pay 30%. And then what I think is do a pre-shipment inspection. So after manufacturing is complete, bring in a third-party inspector. That inspector uses the QC criteria that you put together, you know, plus whatever else they want to add, to review and inspect the products. They'll then send you an inspection report. You'll review the inspection report and then either, you know, then accept the shipment. At that point is when you release the remaining 70% of your funds. Now, in addition to having a process that works better, by telling the supplier up front that you're going to have a third-party inspection done, they realize you're serious and they won't throw the defects into your shipment. They'll throw the defects into somebody else's shipment.
Right, so they will do that, I guess.
So, you know, that's a process that I would recommend. Some people ask, you know, what does a third-party inspection cost? The list rate for most of the, I'll say, reputable first and second tier companies is about $300 US per man day, and a one man day inspection will typically be sufficient for a typical Amazon buyer's order. And in that inspection, the inspector typically will not ship 100% of the products. They'll inspect, based on industry standard statistics, a sample of the products and determine, based on the number of minor, major, or critical problems that they find, whether or not the shipment passes the inspection. But they give you the information and you get to decide whether to accept the product or not.
Fantastically clear. Thank you. So a couple of things. So let me just check that I've understood. So really the key is two things up front, which is you have a list of quality control criteria before you even put an order in. And the second thing is before you even put an order in, you tell the supplier that you're going to have inspection.
Yeah. And include the quality control criteria with the purchase order. So there's no surprises. I mean, there's no sense in keeping it secret. And then some suppliers will tell you, no, I can't achieve this level of quality. And that's fine. You really want to know that early in the process.
Yeah, totally. Tell me about it. Yeah, that's really very good. Now, I was just going to ask about, so when the inspector inspects the sample, according to the industry statistics, are we talking about the AQL?
That's right.
If that's the right term? So can you just explain in sort of simple terms what that is and where should we set the bar, as it were? How fussy should we be? How picky should we be about quality?
Wow, okay. But my suggestion is that the readers, your listeners should Google like AQL quality standards or something like that. But I'll do my best to explain it. So AQL basically creates tables. I mean, the first thing it does, it creates tables that says, hey, if your order size is 1,000 pieces, we're going to check, I think it's like 120 of them. I don't know what the number is, but depending on order size, this is how many we'll check. Then with your quality control criteria, if you're very sophisticated, you very clearly indicate if this problem exists, this constitutes a critical defect. If this problem exists, it constitutes a major defect. If this problem exists, it constitutes a minor defect. So often minor, if you look at it very, very high level, minor is something that probably the customer's not going to return the product for, but you don't really want it that way. Like maybe the box was folded incorrectly. A major defect is something that the buyer may return the product for, even though the product still works. Critical is basically the product doesn't work.
Okay.
So then your next question is, how many critical, how many major, how many minor defects are allowed? And I think that the numbers that the big box retailers in the U.S. usually use are 0, 2.5, and 4. The higher quality guys will use something, I think it's 0, 1, 2.5. But again, Google AQL, and basically that just creates thresholds for within the sample size. There's a table that says if we test 120, if there's more than 6 defects, that's greater than AQL, you know, 4.
And great. Okay. That sounds pretty
clear. All of those numbers come together.
Great. Okay. So it's differentiating clearly between critical, major, and minor defects in your own mind when you're sort of testing samples for yourself, really, so that you are really clear with your factory and then with your inspection all the way through the process.
Correct. And interestingly, when I've talked to the inspection companies, I've asked them, you know, do most shipments pass inspection or not? And they've said, no, actually a lot of shipments do not pass inspection, but they still get shipped. So, you know, that would be pretty common, for example, if there were a lot of minor defects, like, you know, like the packaging was folded incorrectly. But the buyer says, yeah. okay, we need that change for next time, but it's fine for this time. Let's get the product shipped. So
okay. And what's your thinking about that? Do you think that's a wise idea or not a wise idea?
It totally depends on the defect.
Right.
At a high level, if the customer isn't going to give you a lower product review, lower seller feedback, or return the product, it's okay.
That makes a lot of sense. So it doesn't affect your relationship with your Amazon buyers, in other words.
Correct.
The only thing I would say is from my experience that Amazon buyers are super fussy because they've been trained to be by Amazon. So
true.
That's very interesting. But okay, but I guess that you can have a sense of that for yourself. And then that would be a kind of criterion ultimately for, you know what, I'm not going to accept this or I am.
Or I want the supplier to rework it and get another inspection done. But you know, this comes back to if you start beating up on price and then you're going to go ask for super high quality, because like you said, the Amazon customers want pretty good quality. It's difficult to get both.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I would say from my personal perspective, I mean, I'm nothing like your background in this, but from experience, I would not beat down too hard on price, because it's really going to be a problem. If you've got big qualities, a much bigger problem than a slightly too high price, I would say. I'm not getting paid by any suppliers to say this, but yeah, I really think that you've got to be able to have a difficult conversation at the other end and ask for rework or, you know, a refund's a bit messy, but somebody to supply better quality products to replace defective units. So that would be my two penneth from the buyer's point of view.
No, and I would largely concur with that. I think on Amazon, quality is going to be more important than price.
Yeah, it's a really, really important point. Thank you so much for talking us through that. That's very clear, sort of simple guidance, really. Now, I've got a couple of other things. I'm thinking about costs. Just one thing that keeps coming up these days is people that are going from, say, their first or second product shipment, and I'm in this boat as well, thinking about changing from air freight to sea shipping. A few questions about that from the group. First of all, would you recommend having shipping insurance?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one. Many years ago, we did some work helping suppliers sell products, and we got insurance on some of our shipments. And what I personally learned is that insurance providers are the same the world over. And it's very easy to buy insurance, but it's very hard to collect against it.
Right. Okay.
So I think it really depends on what's your tolerance for risk. And, you know, if something happens to the shipment, can you tolerate, you know, losing the money? The probability is pretty low from a purely mathematical perspective. You probably don't need insurance. But if, you know, not receiving that shipment bankrupts you, then maybe you do want insurance.
Yes, I guess bankruptcy is like the ultimate risk. So that makes a lot of sense. So now we've got a couple of other questions about shipping generally. First of all, what is the cost difference between air and sea freight? I guess would be the most important one in my mind as well. And again, it's a how long is a piece of string question, I realize.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. Sam Boyd from Guided Imports, he did a really nice white paper, which I don't think is available anymore. But he was, and I'm not going to get the numbers exactly right, but this will give you an idea. He was looking at water bottles. So water bottles are, call it medium-sized, but not very heavy. And he was comparing the ocean shipping costs and the air shipping costs. And this is for a product that sells probably around $20 US on Amazon, maybe a little less. And I think the air shipping costs ended up being about $6 per unit, and ocean shipping costs were probably a dollar or less than a dollar per unit. So in that case, on a $20 product, you have a $5 difference in shipping price. You know, that's the type of product that in the long run, the guys that are ocean shipping are going to be able to spend more on marketing or have more competitive pricing, and they're going to win. So,
yeah.
You know, I think ocean shipping for a lot of products makes sense. There are some products where it's not necessary if it's super small or super light. The other thing about ocean shipping is there are a lot of fixed costs in ocean shipping. And I'm going to talk mostly from a U.S. perspective. I know mostly about ocean shipping to the U.S. So the fixed cost would be kind of the port fees on both sides. So as a result, a very, very general rule of thumb is if you're below 150 kilograms, maybe do air freight instead of ocean shipping. If you go above that, ocean shipping starts being more cost effective, or 3 cubic meters. Basically, the bigger the shipment is, the more likely ocean shipping makes sense. But then if something's, you know, super big and super light, then air shipping just doesn't make sense at all. You have to ocean ship.
Okay, so very big stuff is also going to be very expensive to air freight because of the, what do they call it, volumetric weight? Is that
the right
term? That's
correct, volumetric weight.
Okay, interesting. So there's a kind of cutoff point of around, what did you say, 150 kilograms?
150 kilograms, 3 cubic meters. Those are numbers that I've heard in the industry.
Okay, great. Well, that gives us a good sort of rule of thumb. And especially, I guess, the kilogram is going to be an easy way to work it out for most of us when we got our product weight quotes from our suppliers. By the way, I have to say, you're the first American I've ever heard use metric terminology. It's quite strange. You've been in Hong Kong a long time.
Well, the interesting thing is the suppliers use a lot of metric terminology, and even the vendors use metric terminology. But that's a fair point. I've been overseas enough that I use a bit of both.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that has struck me, and anyone who's sold on Amazon in the USA for a while will be familiar. You have to sit there constantly converting from metric because that's what suppliers use and that's what most freight companies use. And then, of course, pounds and inches and so forth for the US consumers, but also within Amazon Seller Central. It's a small point, but I would just urge people to double check the difference between inches and centimeters. When you're in Amazon Seller Central in the USA, it's quite easy to go wrong.
Yeah, indeed.
Great. Well, thank you. That gives us some basics of when you should start using sea shipping. And by the sound of it, when you can use sea shipping, it just really slashes the cost. So if you're serious about scaling up a product, at some point, it looks like for most of us, it's going to be a necessary thing to deal with.
I think it's great for scaling up a product and improving margins or improving cost competitiveness. If you don't do it, your competitor might or will.
Yeah.
So like you said, I think for folks that are going to be successful long term, depending on what products they're working on, sea shipping will make a lot of sense.
Great. So a couple of questions then about sea shipping. And I guess this probably applies to shipping generally. There are so many detailed questions around this area. Let's start with some basics. How do you handle customs clearance at a U.S. port? Or in fact, should you do it yourself or not?
No. I see the questions here. I think my short answer to every question is have your freight forwarder do it.
Right. Okay.
So you call up your freight forwarder. They'll ask you, okay, do you want it X Works or FOB? Which basically means, do I need to pick it up at the factory, or will the factory bring it to the port and we'll pick it up and we'll get it at the port? And then they're going to say, where do you want it delivered to? And then they'll give you a quote, and the quote will include the port fees on the China side, the ocean freight fees, the port fees on the, and I'll say U.S. side, and then depending on where you're having it delivered, inland freight fees, and they may or may not include duty in the quote, but regardless, when they bill you, they will bill you for the duties. And then done, they just right. do it all.
Okay, so basically for sea shipping, you absolutely have to have a freight forwarder is what you're saying.
I don't know how you do it without a freight forwarder, so yeah, I think I am
fine.
Saying that.
Okay, fine. No, that's really nice and clear. I mean, you know, there's always going to be tiny exceptions to rules, but we're not looking for like engineering level solutions, I guess, but just generally good advice. So when it comes to air freight, what would you recommend using a freight forwarder? Is it possible to just do without?
You know, I'm not as familiar with air freight, and I also get a little bit confused between air courier and air freight.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I looked into that a while ago myself, but I never quite got the clarity of explanation that I was looking for. So.
Yeah, so I think air courier would be like DHL or FedEx or UPS, and air freight would be more like working with a freight forwarder. So like, for example, I was talking to the folks at Flexport in the US, and they do both air and ocean freight. And I think if I remember correctly, they might've said that it's about half and half for their business. That I don't remember exactly. But I think that the point is that most freight forwarders, if I understand correctly, can handle either air or ocean freight. And you can even get their advice. Hey, what do you recommend? Should I ship this by air or ocean? Is it worth getting a quote for each? And they should be able to give you some good feedback.
Right. So in other words, ask the expert and then just follow it. That sounds very good, particularly if you're starting out. One question then with freight forward is, do you need a separate customs broker, or is that normally included in what the freight forwarder would do?
In my experience, the freight forwarder does that. They either have an in-house customs broker or they have a relationship with a customs broker. So your freight forwarder is kind of your one-stop go-to point of contact for all of that.
Great. So, well, okay, that eliminates a lot of questions around sea shipping, that kind of stuff as well. Now, another question, again, coming back to the relationship with the supplier, so sort of jumping back into the supply chain. When you're making initial contact with suppliers in China, should you act as if you're the buyer and have to okay prices with my boss? And there's been so much discussion about this, and I hear different people doing different things, and I've experimented with it. What's your experience with that?
I've seen people do it both ways. From my personal perspective, I don't really recommend starting a relationship with a supplier with untruths.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I think, and usually if you look at why people are saying, you know, pretend that I'm not the boss, it's for price negotiation so that later on you can say my boss didn't accept the price. And then we get back to the issue of, well, you know, what's more important, price or quality? And is that whatever 3% discount on price that you're going to get worth the extra time and the aggravation? I think everybody has to decide for themselves. I don't think there's a both can work.
So, yeah, it's a very good point. So you've got to be clear-minded about why you want to even employ this little tactic. And I guess it's about price. And if you're going to negotiate on price, I suppose you were implying earlier, it's more about comparing quotes than it is worrying about a boss that doesn't exist.
That's what I've seen the traditional retailers do. They focus more on getting multiple quotes and then comparing. The other thing that the traditional retailers will do, and this is going to be harder for Amazon sellers, is they'll figure out, you know, what's the bill of materials? What are the costs of each of the components? What's the labor cost? You know, so what should the right price be? And then add a little markup for the supplier. So those are two strategies that I've seen retailers employ. I think the get the multiple quotes one is a little bit easier for the Amazon sellers.
Definitely. Although it's very interesting that you're sort of building up from the cost price plus a bit of a markup, because I understand that the Chinese factories basically run at cost price and then they get a tiny tax rebate if they're selling. So more or less the price you get is very close to the cost of production. Is that tie in with your experience?
Yeah, I mean, certainly some factories, most of their money is from the VAT rebate that they get when the products export, and that varies by product category. And I don't remember the numbers, but I think it can be, I think the maximum is 17%, although there aren't that many product categories at 17%. If I remember correctly, there might be a number of product categories around 9%. My information on that may be outdated.
Okay. But I mean, so the principle is really that your supplier is quite often going to be quoting you a price that is pretty close to their break even anyway. Is that a reasonable statement?
Well, I guess it depends on if you're getting a good quote or not. If you're getting a good quote, it's probably close to their break even.
Okay.
If not, it might not.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. Yeah, okay. That's interesting. Okay, so the simple version is go and get multiple quotes and then go back to your preferred supplier and say, we'd love to work with you, but here's a quote from X Good Factory. Could you beat that, or can you begin to get close to it, or something like that? Is that about right?
I think that's the easiest and the most straightforward way to do it, especially for Amazon sellers.
Great. Sounds very good advice. Now, another interesting question that came up I wasn't expecting, but any advice on sourcing from the US, the UK, and European manufacturers?
You know, that's not something that we focus on kind of at all. So I think the issues are probably largely the same, but yeah, I don't have any advice on that one.
Great, thank you. Well, I think that wraps up most of the sort of logistics and small picture stuff.
There was one other small question here that I'll address. I think somebody asked, you know, can I use a Gmail address?
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to say the suppliers, you know, they're getting more sophisticated also. And I've heard some suppliers, they'll take your company name and your name and go into LinkedIn and look you up to try to learn more about your company. And what's also interesting to me is the good suppliers are capacity constrained, and it's hard to get their attention. maybe the entry-level suppliers or the brand new suppliers that'll work with anybody, they may not be the ones that you want to work with. And the ones that you want to work with are probably the more experienced ones that may be more selective in who they bring on as new customers. In order to convince those suppliers to work with you, you want to present yourself as well as possible. And, you know, just a Gmail address with no company information may not be the best way to do that. That being said, some of the larger retailers, the buyers from the larger retailers, they use Gmail and Hotmail addresses so that they don't get their corporate email address spammed when they initially contact suppliers. But I would still lean toward, you know, try to have a company domain, try to have a company website. In your inquiry to the supplier, give them some background about you that makes you sound like an experienced and legitimate buyer. Or if you're a brand new buyer, just something about your background that makes them want to work with you. Sell yourself to them. And that can help improve both responsiveness, maybe pricing, make the supplier more interested to want to work with you. And all of that, you know, really helps make orders go more smoothly.
Wow, how helpful was that? I have certainly learned some serious amounts of things myself from that really are going to tighten up the way I work with suppliers, and also some big picture thinking as well. So that brings us on to the next thing, which is today was very much focused on the tactics and the sort of nitty gritty, which I asked Peter if we could, you know, get some questions from you guys, the listeners, via the Facebook group, and lots of them, as you heard, came in. But I also asked Peter to expand his own thinking on strategy, which he's very, very good at. So big picture thinking going forward, how is Amazon going to develop, how to cope with competition, and how to grow a really serious business and brand of your own that can move beyond Amazon as well. So that is going to be in the second half of the interview, which will be in episode number 35. Today's episode was number 34. And as ever, you will be able to get the blog notes, the show notes rather, at the blog www.amazingfba.com/34. Look out for the next episode, episode 35, where you get the strategic hints and big picture stuff from Peter. Meanwhile, don't forget to go and implement this stuff. It's no good just learning this stuff and then doing nothing about it. But if you're in the middle of the sourcing cycle, go and make some serious notes, go check the blog notes, and then obviously make sure that you're going to implement this stuff. I mean, there's so many things that even if you've done it once and you've done it badly, okay, resolve to learn for next time. And that's absolutely the case with me. No question that I wish I'd met Peter before, but I haven't. So I've learned from the past, I've learned from my mistakes, and now I can go and implement some of Peter's fantastic tactics and general approaches and do much, much better at this stuff. So until next time, folks, as ever, if you want to get in touch and share your comments, by far the best place is the Facebook group, www.amazingfba.com/FB, F as in face, B as in book. Other than that, go implement this stuff, and good luck, Godspeed, and speak to you in the next podcast.